From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, in U.S. custody, Abu Anas al-Libi, but his family claims the al-Qaeda suspect was illegally detained by the United States.
They don't know where he is. They were aware of being watched in the run-up to the raid.
Also today, day six of the U.S. government shutdown. There's no end in sight. No end in sight, too, to the recession in the Netherlands. We report from Rotterdam and from Brussels, where a battle is underway over the future of European Union interpreters.
Interpreters are a very rare merchandise.
And how Benjamin Netanyahu sparked a social media uprising in Iran with talk of blue jeans. That's ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has been defending the capture of an allegedly senior al-Qaeda leader in Libya at the weekend. Abu Anas al-Libi was seized in a raid involving U.S. special forces in Tripoli. He's suspected of masterminding the attacks on U.S. embassies in Africa in 1998. The Libyan Prime Minister's office has asked the U.S. for clarification of the operation inside its territory. But John Kerry, speaking in Indonesia, says the suspect has been indicted in a New York court in connection with the 1998 attacks.
An indictment is an accusation. In our legal system, a defendant is presumed innocent until proven guilty, but he will now have an opportunity to defend himself and to be appropriately brought to justice in a court of law. And I think it's important for people in the world not to sympathize with alleged terrorists, but to underscore the importance of rule of law.
At least 50 people have been killed in Egypt after violent clashes erupted as the country marked the 40th anniversary of the Arab-Israeli War. Cairo witnessed the worst of the violence as supporters of deposed President Mohamed Morsi clashed with opposition and security forces. The violence was followed by two separate attacks on security forces, which left 9 soldiers and police officers dead. Analysts suggest the attacks are part of a growing backlash against the crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. Cairo-based journalist Belle True says the picture is still unclear.
A car bomb basically ripped open several floors of a security directorate down in a small town called Otour, where meanwhile 5 police officers were gunned down in what appeared to be a drive-by shooting in the Suez Canal city of Ismailia. In addition, there was a rocket-propelled grenade attack on a state satellite station in Mahdi in Cairo. These are all widely being seen by authorities to be possibly retaliatory attacks on security forces, although we haven't got any confirmation of whether they were in fact related.
The US government shutdown has entered its second week with no end in sight. The Obama administration, which shows no sign of caving into Republican demands, is now scrambling to reassure international partners the gridlock will not damage relations. Nina Maria Potts in Washington reports.
A weekend of gridlock in Washington, followed by intense diplomacy abroad to try and convince U.S. allies the government shutdown won't hurt relations. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spent the weekend telling trading partners the stalemate won't affect long-term commitments or investments. This after President Barack Obama cancelled a crucial trip to Asia, blaming the Republicans on Capitol Hill for bringing the government to a standstill. U.S. officials also cancelled crucial trade negotiations with the European Union in Brussels, telling their counterparts it's impossible to move ahead with the talks. And in Washington, neither side shows any sign of caving in. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. 3 American scientists have been awarded this year's Nobel Prize in Medicine for their work on understanding how the body's cells function. Their research has implications for those with diabetes and a variety of other diseases, as they help learn how chemicals are distributed throughout the body. Rebecca Foster reports from Washington.
James Rothman of Yale University, Randy Scheckman of the University of California at Berkeley, and German-born Thomas Sudhoff of Stanford University share the distinguished honor for their individual cellular research. The scientists investigated how, where, and when vesicles move chemicals around the body. These chemicals include insulin, which is critical for those with diabetes. Their work also affects those with neurological disorders like Alzheimer's, which are known to be related to a damaged chemical transport system. Over 100 Nobel Prizes in physiology or medicine have been awarded since the prize's inception in 1895. Rebecca Foster, Washington.
the Olympic flame relay ceremony kicked off in the capital of Russia. The torch, lit in ancient Olympia in Greece, landed at Moscow's Vnukovo Airport and was taken to the Kremlin. From there, it will travel across the country for 123 days. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
497 torchbearers are to participate in the two-day Moscow leg of the Olympic flame relay. After the celebrations in Moscow, attended by tens of thousands of visitors and Moscovites, the torch will start its 65,000-kilometer journey across the country. For 123 days, some 14,000 torchbearers will carry the flame through 2,900 towns across 83 regions of Russia. The Olympic torch will make its final stop at the resort city of Sochi on February 7, 2014, and light the cauldron at the Fished Olympic Stadium. Daria Bondarchuk, Moscow.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News, Kevin McAleese reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
He is a key al-Qaeda figure, and he is a legal and an appropriate target for the U.S. military under the authorization of the use of military force passed in September of 2001.
Secretary of State John Kerry speaking today in Indonesia about the U.S. raid in Libya on Saturday that resulted in the detention of Abu Anas al-Libi, allegedly an al-Qaeda mastermind involved in the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The Libyan government says it knew nothing of the U.S. commando raid in Tripoli until after it's happened, and it's demanding an explanation from the Obama administration amid growing public concern in Libya that the United States breached the country's sovereignty. We begin our coverage in Tripoli, where we spoke to journalist William Crisp.
The Libyan government's in a very awkward situation now. A lot of Tripoli residents that I've talked to are very angry with the government. They think, firstly, if the government didn't know about this, this is a disaster. It shows just how weak it really is. And then if they did know about it, well, that's a disaster as well because they've lied to the people. I spoke to al-Libi's son just this afternoon. I met at his house where the raid actually took place, and he's very angry with the Libyan government and says if his father is to stand trial anywhere, he should be standing it here in Libya.
So does the family plan to fight the legal basis for Anas al-Libi's detention?
His son told me that his father fought with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, but his father is not a terrorist. The family says that he doesn't know Osama bin Laden and had nothing to do with the Nairobi embassy bombings. They say that actually before he was abducted, he said he'd like to have a fair trial just so he could clear his name after so many years of being on the run.
And has the family been contacted at all by the United States with regard to Mr. al-Libi's whereabouts?
The family said they didn't expect the attack, and they said they don't know where he is. They said, though, they were aware of being watched in the run-up to the raid. They said that they thought that it was possible they were afraid of an airstrike, actually, on their house, they told me. But they said that it was a bit of a surprise, the kind of abduction by car which actually occurred.
And talk a little bit more about the Libyan government's possible role here. Is there reason to believe that the Libyan government was informed by the United States before this took place?
Talking to the family, they told me that 10 people took part in the raid, which some family members saw from the window of the house. It happened just feet away from the entrance to their house. They say they heard the attackers talking in Libyan with a Tripoli dialect. 7 of them were looked untrained, and they looked like they were Libyans. But 3 of them looked different from the rest, wearing balaclavas, using silenced automatic pistols. So it does seem there was a team of Libyans and the U.S. perhaps working together here. Some things are pointing towards that. But whether these Libyans were working for the government or whether they were working for the United States directly, it's hard to tell.
William Crisp on the line from Tripoli. It's reported that Abu Anas al-Libi is now being interrogated by US officials aboard the USS San Antonio, an amphibious transport ship which sailed to the region ahead of Saturday's raid. He had a $5 million bounty on his head and was one of the FBI's most wanted suspects. My colleague here in Washington, Daniel Wrenches, has been looking at the US version of Saturday's events and joins me now. Daniel, other than what Secretary of State Kerry has had to say, has the administration made any other comment on the legality surrounding Mr. al-Libi's detention?
Not at this time, but the justification is clearly going to be that people in other countries who were carrying out terrorist activities against the United States could be defined as enemy combatants and therefore subject to the laws of war within the United States. Therefore, it's likely that this suspect will be defined as an enemy combatant and at some point brought into the United States for a civilian trial.
And the theory is that that legal proceeding could take place in New York.
Yes, that's right. But there is still a question mark about when this individual might be brought into the United States, because in 2011, Ahmed Abdul Qadir Wasame, a former military commander with the Al-Shabaab movement in Somalia, was brought on board a US Navy ship in the Gulf of Aden and kept there for about 2 months without being given access to legal rights or a lawyer. They may think that they have the opportunity to garner intelligence from him.
But we have no information about whether, for example, Mr. al-Libi has had his rights read to him or anything like that. He would presumably be treated as a high-value target and be facing an extensive interrogation that may be taking place without the direct knowledge of the Libyan authorities.
That's right. But what Secretary Kerry has been very clear to point out today is that he will be subject to the normal legal procedures. He is innocent until proven guilty. It suggests to me that the Obama administration wants to get away from the shadowy, shady world of the Bush administration, even though their actions clearly have some questionable legalities in Libya itself. So they will be wanting to demonstrate, for example, that they don't use extraordinary rendition, the process that the CIA was involved in, and making it clear that this is a military operation and not an intelligence operation. So drawing out the paramilitary aspects of the CIA and wanting to show not only the American people, but the international community that they're prepared to use normal civil procedures to prosecute this individual.
And in other words, not send him to Guantanamo Bay. Daniel Wrenches at FSN's Washington Bureau. Thank you very much indeed. Tomorrow marks a week since parts of the US government shut down, and there are few signs of progress on a deal between House Republicans and Senate Democrats to get the wheels of government moving again. But some elements of the US government are functioning at full steam. Ahead of a rally Tuesday for immigration reform, some activists and lawmakers say immigration detentions and deportations are continuing despite the shutdown, while many visa and passport applications are suspended. From Capitol Hill, Alice Alstein reports.
Tension is rising in Washington as the U.S. inches closer to a possible default, which will happen if Congress fails to raise the Treasury's borrowing limit by October 17th. Senate Democrats announced Monday that they will debate and vote on a bill to raise the debt ceiling later this week and are demanding the House of Representatives do the same. House Democrats have also submitted what's called a discharge petition, an obscure legislative move to force House Speaker John Boehner to bring up a clean bill to reopen the government, something he has so far refused to do. But over a rare weekend session of Congress, Republican lawmakers continued to demand more compromises in exchange for raising the debt ceiling and reopening the government. Texas Republican Ted Cruz laid out his priorities on CNN.
Number one, we should look for some significant structural plan to reduce government spending. Number two, we should avoid new taxes. And number three, we should look for ways to mitigate the harms from Obamacare.
Democrats maintain their stance that they will discuss these issues, but only after the government is reopened. On Monday, President Obama spoke to a group of federal employees at FEMA who have been working for a week without pay and said that allowing Republicans to extract policy demands under threat of default would set a dangerous precedent.
There's not a subject that I am not willing to engage in, work on, negotiate, and come up with common sense compromises on. What I've said is that I cannot do that under the threat that if Republicans don't get 100% of their way, they're going to either shut down the government or they are going to default on America's debt.
As the shutdown enters its second week, immigrants' rights advocates are calling attention to its impact on the nation's immigration system. Much of the U.S. Border Patrol and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency has been shielded from the impact of the shutdown. But the courts where immigrants can argue their cases for citizenship, the office where they can report civil rights and civil liberties violations, and the centers that process most passport and visa applications have been indefinitely closed. Joe Comerford with the National Priorities Project says these discrepancies are indicative of the values of the U.S. government.
The kinds of ways that people would need support in their immigration cases or the kinds of ways that they would want to get information about relatives, all of those will either be desperately slowed or unavailable, whereas some of the deportations and or arrests or incarceration, people are reporting that they don't see those slowing down.
Thousands of people from across the country will gather on the National Mall on Tuesday for a major rally to demand Congress pass a comprehensive immigration reform bill that treats undocumented people with, quote, dignity and respect. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Money talks, but it don't sing and dance and it don't walk. Long as I can have you here with me, I'd much rather be forever in blue jeans.
Neil Diamond waxing lyrical about the joys of a pair of blue jeans. But while denim didn't do Mr. Diamond's career any harm, the same is not true today for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He has sparked an uprising on social media after telling the BBC's Persian service that Iran's democracy is faulty and its people are aspiring for the hallmarks of Western consumerism. Here's what he said.
I think if the Iranian people had their way, they'd be wearing blue jeans, they'd have Western music, they'd have free elections, they'd be free to choose whoever they want, and they wouldn't pay this awful price that they're paying economically with these sanctions for a program that their own regime says they don't want.
Well, the reaction from many Iranians was immediate. Many of them took to Twitter and other social media outlets to post pictures of themselves wearing blue jeans and listening to Western music. Mr. Netanyahu's comments come after a week that began with his address at the UN General Assembly warning the US against the overtures from Iran's new reformist president, Hassan Rouhani. So what are the implications for US policymakers of the Israeli Prime Minister's tough line on Iran? FSN's Priscilla Huff reports from our Washington bureau.
Everywhere he's gone over the past week, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has delivered the same message.
Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Iran's new president, he argues, is playing the West, showing a reformist side of a country that remains controlled by conservative clerical forces, notably the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
Israel will never acquiesce to nuclear arms in the hands of a rogue regime that repeatedly promises to wipe us off the map.
Michael Adler is a public policy scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and argues the Israelis are historically reticent to embrace Iran's nuclear olive branch.
So this is the Israeli concern, and Netanyahu was sounding that alarm and saying, amidst all this good-feeling talk, don't forget what's happened in the past, which is that while they've talked, they've developed facts on the ground. And don't be fooled, they're trying to delay on presenting that point of view.
But Mr. Netanyahu's concerns notwithstanding, the White House is currently putting diplomacy first. President Obama's historic telephone call with President Rouhani set the tone. It was the first direct contact between the two countries' leaders since the Iranian Revolution of 1979. Secretary of State John Kerry.
It would be diplomatic malpractice of the worst order not to examine every possibility of whether or not you can achieve that before you ask people to take military action or do what you have to do in order to prevent something from happening.
Iran's new foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, now has the nuclear talks portfolio under President Rouhani. He's indicating the country is genuine about taking a new approach to the nuclear discussion as Western sanctions contribute to a reported inflation rate of 30% in Iran and a reported unemployment rate of 1 in 5. The Wilson Center's Michael Adler thinks American diplomats should approach the upcoming talks in Geneva with some key questions.
How can we start making progress? How can we structure a deal that works for you and that works for us? We know your concerns. You know our concerns. We should be able to work something out. When they start really seriously sitting down and talking in that spirit, you've got to think they can work out a deal, because in a way, they're not that far apart.
The next opportunity to test Iran's sincerity will come at a round of talks due to get underway in Geneva next week. As the conversations begin, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to maintain that diplomacy will not work. But for now, the Obama administration does not appear to be listening. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
Now to the Netherlands, and as some areas of the Eurozone are starting to experience the green shoots of an economic recovery, Holland is still mired in recession. With a rising unemployment rate and the Dutch government implementing billions of euros worth of budget cuts and tax hikes, more pain is expected. Many families and businesses are feeling the effects, as FSN's Natalie Feary reports from the country's second largest city, Rotterdam.
At the Rotterdam headquarters of the Netherlands Food Bank, some of the 6,500 volunteers are getting ready to prepare food boxes. They send them out to 30,000 Dutch families a week. Among them is the founder of the organisation, Clara Sees, who set up the food bank with her husband.
This is small packages of drink for the children, cookies, tea, and then we put also the milk products, pudding, milk, things like that, and meat products.
With an economy that continues to shrink and a government that is ramping up austerity measures, the number of people in the Netherlands using the food bank is on the rise. Some are among the 8.7% of the population that is unemployed, levels not seen since the 1980s. But a growing number of visitors have jobs, though are struggling to make ends meet. According to the founder of the food bank, Clara Sees.
9 years ago, you saw people coming, low education. And what we see now is, well, everything. High educated people who had their own business. We see everybody from high to low, everything.
Dutch citizens are now the most indebted in the Eurozone. As people try to get their debts under control, the country is seeing a major slump in domestic demand. And as people spend less, Dutch businesses are also suffering. Yuan Nguyen owns a jewellery shop in what was once a busy pedestrianised shopping street in the centre of Rotterdam. His shop now sees about a quarter of the customers it did 3 years ago. In a bid to help drive business, Yuan started to buy gold, which he says many cash-strapped people are now desperate to sell.
Say, are you sure? Do you really want to sell it? Because it's emotional things. So it's a little bit sad. But it's nothing we can do about it now.
And Yuan is among the lucky ones. In July, 25 companies a day in the Netherlands went bankrupt, the highest reading in over 30 years. And the tough economic climate is set to continue, according to Peter Vogels, the head of the economics desk at Holland's AD newspaper.
The problem gets worse by the austerity measures from the government. Unemployment will rise for a long time still, even if the economy starts growing again.
Most analysts do not expect the economy in the Netherlands to pick up until at least 2015 or 2016. With 10% of the Dutch population now living in poverty, aid organisations that usually send help abroad are now planning to provide support at home. Back at the food bank, Clara hopes they will be able to cope.
Because of the crisis, the food producers are looking more strictly to their production lines. We get less food in, but we have to hand out more.
Demand is set to grow by another 20% this year alone. and Clara expects it to be the busiest year since she founded the organisation 11 years ago. Natalie Fury, Rotterdam.
Now, as the European Union looks to cut spending wherever it can in solidarity with crisis-hit economies across the bloc, calls have emerged to revamp the way politicians and diplomats use interpreters. The EU runs on 24 official languages, employs thousands of highly skilled and highly paid interpreters, many of whom are not always used and cost taxpayers millions of euros a year. But interpreting staff say that any cuts to their services will have serious consequences on the future of the profession and the democratic foundations of the European Union. FSN's Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports from Brussels.
Inside dozens of European Union buildings, high-level talks take place every day, and every month, legislature is debated at the European Parliament, not in six official languages like at the United Nations, but in 24 different European languages. Employing more than 3,000 multilingual interpreters, the EU's languages services are highly esteemed, hiring top professionals with a specific set of skills. José Regueras is from Spain.
First, you have to have patience and not anticipate where the speaker is going. Then you have to analyze. You also need a sound understanding of your mother tongue because you need to be a very good communicator.
But as European governments rein in their spending to combat a debt crisis, the EU is being pressed to make cuts too. And in the last 3 years, 16 million euros went to waste due to late requests or cancellations when interpreters weren't needed. It's prompted Esther de Lange, a Dutch member of the European Parliament, to push for an on-demand system.
Within my political group, I'm the only person who's a Dutch speaker. But this is very technical discussions often, and I know it's better to speak German to my German colleagues and French to my French colleagues, or speak English, and I do. So in those cases, I don't need three interpreters to wait for me to pick up my headset to need translation. They are good, but they do cost more than 1,000 euros a day.
The concern with on-demand interpreting, though, is that it'll lead to a privileged treatment of popular languages like English, French, and German. And that goes against the EU's democratic foundations that allow equal representation of each member state. According to Olga Kosmidou, the EU's head of interpretation and conferences.
In European Parliament, we have directly elected people, which means that you cannot elect people for their knowledge. You elect them because they are capable to represent you, and so we have to give them the tools to be on the same level.
Chatter in EU corridors of potential cutbacks are also fueling fears about the future of an industry already seeing shortages. Not only do more politicians speak English, but there are less professional native English interpreters around because of that. Olga Kosmidou again.
Interpreters at the level we want them are a very, very rare merchandise, especially for certain languages. We give money in order to go to the capitals of all the states and find the right universities to train them. And then, if these people, who are very rare birds, are convinced that this profession doesn't have a future, then they do something different.
Many agree greater efficiency is necessary, but the EU's interpreting staff argue it's the users who should be more responsible and that any institutional changes will ultimately affect the right of every language to have an equal say in Europe. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the programme by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. Coming up tomorrow, we'll look at the new term ahead for the US Supreme Court. That's Tuesday. But for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington, alongside producer Kevin McAleese. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.